VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm here with 40 minutes of free football opinion you can take and claim as your own, if you like. But if you disagree with me, there are three other opinions you can help yourself to. It's those of the excellent Rory K. Smith, the ever more excellent Matt Dickinson, and of course, our boss, Tony Evans, the most excellent one of all. Later on, we'll be discussing the truth, lies, and alcohol consumption of the QPR squad, but we start in North London. Dick, I want to start with you. On the back page of the Times today, there's a headline whereby AVB says Arsenal are now caught in a negative spiral. But then by the same token, I hear Arsene Wenger saying that they dominated the game and Spurs' two goals were against the run of play. Where do you stand?
Well, I mean, it's fair to say for Wenger that his team started pretty well. They were pressing. They were trying to play this high defensive line that I'm sure we'll turn to. Cazorla had a very decent game. Wiltshire didn't. I mean, you know, they had some productive players. The trouble was, of course, they had those 3 minutes where that high defensive line was completely undone, and the game was encapsulated in those couple of minutes, and that's all it took. And it's, of course, a recurrent problem for Arsenal that their defensive organisation is simply not good enough, and their defensive individuals are simply not good enough. And I think Vermaelen, to me, sums it up. He is a better player, a far, far better player than he looks in that Arsenal defence, and that raises all kinds of questions about coaching, organisation, confidence. I could go on.
Tony, Stuart Robson's basically been saying what we just heard for the last 3 years, maybe, if not longer. The fact that they play this high defensive line, to me at least, it shows that they are trying to do something differently defensively. But of course, it also comes down to execution. Why can't they execute defensively?
I think Dickle's right. I think they haven't got the personnel to play the high defensive line. They haven't got the pace. If you're going to hold the line like that, you need someone who, if it all goes wrong, can get back. And the ponderous at the back, it's, I must say, I did think they were a bit unfortunate on the first goal. Adebayo runs offside, he knows he's offside, and he stays there and freezes the defence. That's getting an advantage from doing something that's illegal. So, I mean, I hate that rule, but...
I mean, if he's offside, then the defence know he's offside, then they know he's there. He can't touch the ball. He becomes active if he interferes, if he makes a run.
Jesus, that becomes active. I'm a believer in if you're on the pitch, you're active. But anyway, let's move on. But the fact is, it's simply that he hasn't got the personnel to play it. They don't press well enough in midfield. They don't finish up well enough in attack. And you can see that Arsenal are, if not in decline, they're stagnating.
It shouldn't just blame the... I mean, it was easy to scapegoat the centre-halves, but as Tony says, there's the pressing in midfield. And then there's also the goalkeeper who, again, I mean, I was convinced a year, 18 months ago, that Chesney was Arsenal's keeper for the next 10 years and a very promising one. And, this was a guy who was going to be near the top of his profession. And, if you're going to... his confidence looks shredded. The guy can barely trap a ball, can't pass it 5 yards without giving me the palpitations, never mind his own defenders. And also, you know, if you're going to play that way, he's not a sweeper keeper, and that was part of the problem. You know, he's not a guy who comes off his line and gives you any confidence.
Roy, do you want to continue lambasting the Arsenal defense, or do you want to focus on the front four? Because as I saw it, I saw a lot of sterile possession. I saw them actually moving the ball quite ponderously compared to the way they normally do, sort of zipping it about. And I didn't see very many shots on goal at all, which I thought was rather un-Arsenal-like.
Well, they have shot more in the last couple of years than they used to, I think. So it's un-Arsenal-like in that sense, but it's not un-Arsenal-like as of 4 or 5 years ago.
No, but as of this season, I mean, if
they have obviously tried to do that. But I think what Dicko said about Vermaelen's right. I don't actually know if I think Vermaelen's one of those players that we all think is really good, because he should be really good, and you know he's got a good reputation. We all think he's a solid defender, but if you actually watch Thomas Vermaelen, He falls over more than most human beings I've ever met. He falls over a lot, Thomas Vermaelen, to the extent that I'm worried there is something slightly wrong in his brain, because he's always falling over. But what's definitely true is that even if he's not got worse at Arsenal, he's not got any better. And that is because the defensive coaching isn't enough. In terms of the stylistic stuff going forward, there was this idea that Arsenal were the best team to watch in England. It is not true at all, and hasn't been true for some time. Arsenal play a kind of middle-of-the-road, cold-play style passing football, where they sort of shift it about a bit. They do a bit of the horseshoeing around the box, and they come back again, and it's all sort of okay to watch. But they're not a sort of particularly penetrating team. They're not particularly pacey. They've got Walcott, I suppose, who's quick, but that's it. They're not particularly dangerous in the air. Obviously, Giroud's sort of all right in the air. They're okay to watch. They're not great to watch. There's nothing that defines Arsenal, and they look like a team that's kind of devoid of a purpose almost. There's no point to Arsenal, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And I think yesterday's result was really significant, because it was telling that Spurs started badly and ended nervously, and that's because of the complex they've got about Arsenal. And beating them is probably enough, you'd think is enough, to kind of shake that off a little bit, that little brother complex, to make Spurs realise that they're certainly the best team in North London, if not in all of London.
All right, that sets us up for a nice transition into Spurs, because all this character assassination of Arsenal and questioning Arsenal's purpose to even exist was making me rather uncomfortable. Dicko, the focus with Spurs is going to be on Gareth Bale, inevitably, but let's not talk about him. Can you praise a couple other guys first before we move to the inevitable Bale discussion, like, say, Vertonghen, who you gave very high marks to?
Yeah, and I thought he was very good, and he's been a shrewd signing. He can play a couple of positions on the back line, but I think he's best at centre half. And he just looked supreme yesterday. He was making big tackles, making them cleanly, and oozing the kind of confidence that Arsenal just can't match. I thought he was excellent. I thought it was most interesting. I mean, I'd much prefer to see Dembele further forward. I thought he did that more at Fulham. I think he's a far more creative player than we saw yesterday, but he played where he was needed. Where he was needed, he played with a discipline. He kept it tidy. He did his job, and I say I don't think it's the job that he's best suited for by a long way. But he did his job effectively. It's interesting. Parker was getting battered. I saw on Twitter at one stage. Maybe we shouldn't pay too much attention to that. But just as he was, I actually thought the last 20 minutes, just when Spurs were in danger of being driven back, he, as much as anyone, started trying to drive them forward. They just looked like a team that knew their roles, and they, largely to a man, performed them very well. I mean, Sigurdsson had hardly touched the ball for the first 15 minutes and then slides that ball through for the first goal. So I would have thought Adebayor, to be honest, was the only player they had who really stunk.
Tony, how good are they? Can you put this into some context? Because remember, I mean, obviously Sandro's injured. You presume they'd be a better team with him in there. But it seems to me like he's sort of assembled this whole sort of coterie of attacking midfielder types, because I think that's what Dembele is naturally, even though he's playing further back. And you can do that. And if they all work
hard for each other if they're all disciplined to some degree, if they all pay attention, if they're all clever. And they all seem to be. And remember, there's also guys like Dempsey, like Holtby, who we haven't mentioned. That's kind of neat what AVB's done. Some love, maybe?
Well, yeah. I mean, especially after last year, you know, we were talking about character assassination. All we got coming out of Chelsea was negativity. You know, the tales of his arrogance and, you know, sort of his football, his unwillingness to listen to other people.
It could be that he's grown and improved and learned something because he is 22 years old, after all.
Yeah, and then it could be that Chelsea's unmanageable. But, you know, he's gone over there and he's gone about his business. And the same sort of stories that we'd heard last year and not coming out of White Hart Lane, you know, it's all positive. So yeah, he's done a really good job. It's a midfield that's got plenty of attacking options. And, you know, we talked about Parker, who gives them an anchor at ground and he'll protect the centre-halves. And it looks like a unit that's coming together. And it looks like a team that's improving. And, you know, could be the second best team in the country at the moment.
After Manchester United, I presume.
Yeah.
See, note how grudgingly he says that. Rory, we didn't. I didn't want to overemphasize Bale because we've all been doing it, but I guess he deserves a mention.
Yeah, he's a very good player, Gareth Bale. But I think more interesting than Gareth Bale is Villas-Boas. So at the start of the season, when there was all the problems with Michael Dawson, it looked like Villas-Boas was kind of repeating the mistake he'd made at Chelsea, which is go in, tackle the inherent power base, you sort of ignore the reality of the situation and try and impose your philosophy, your theory top down. But this season, I think Villas-Boas' great triumph is that he's adapted that. He's not playing the 4-3-3 with the rotating midfield that he did at Porto. He's shown a bit of nuance, he's shown a bit of subtlety, and he's got the team playing the best they can with the resources at his disposal, rather than saying this is how I want you to play, try and fit in. And that's the art of good management, and he obviously has grown. And I think what's crucial in terms of, and this is where I'll bring it back to Bale for you, Gab, in terms of his reputation, is that Bale clearly loves playing for him. It was interesting, you know, when he went to celebrate, I think it was after the second goal at West Ham in the week, he went and grabbed the Aspas, you know, really sort of a great big bear hug from Bale. He's obviously clearly enjoying working with him, and from what you hear from the players at Spurs, they love Villas-Boas' training sessions, they love the way he's innovative and all that. So he has restored his reputation in 9 months at Spurs, and part of that is because he's getting the best out of Bale, because he's given him this free role which basically allows him to do what he wants, and as Tony Castorino said in the paper last week, basically makes Bale completely and utterly unmanageable.
Dicko, going back to Villas-Boas for a second, one of my pet hates is we kind of assume that you know, we have an idea of, like, okay, so this manager is like this, and we kind of assume that managers are sort of fixed in time and that, you know, they're the same people, like, in different jobs and different situations, in different moments in time. That's not the case. It's entirely possible for AVB to get everything wrong in one place and then do everything better. In the same way, it's entirely possible for, say, Mourinho to have worked very well in certain situations and not so well in others, right? I mean, you don't
you're
turn
bringing,
up and...
You're bringing all your fancy continental ways, you see. You're judging as you know, by a specific regime, whereas we like to judge a character, and we like to, you know, say basically this guy is you know, a certain type of bloke and a certain type of manager, and then, as you say, that image is fixed for the next 175 years. But no, you're right. We should learn, and I think maybe AVB will help us to learn that, as you say, it is about, you know, specific circumstances of a job, and that managers. I think the Chelsea situation was partly the madness of Chelsea, and it was partly clearly AVB trying to second guess when he came in the type of job he needed to do, the type of person he needed to be, and I think he sort of contrived a persona clearly to try and sort of enforce that. You know, I mean, as Tony mentioned, I mean, some of the sort of horror stories that were coming out of the hierarchy at Chelsea about the sort of character, you know, the character he had become. They didn't recognise him from his previous existence. He was arrogant. He was an unpleasant guy to work around. And I mean, maybe to some he was, but I think he had sort of tried to turn himself into something at Chelsea to try and sort of match the pressure of that job. He seems to be. More himself at Spurs, as Rory says, he seems to be evolving and relaxing. And as you say, it is possible for managers to change, people to change, and that's his greatest achievement, I guess, is that he's showing that he's learned from lessons. And if you know, hopefully we can all do that in life.
Tony, the other big story from the weekend, a bunch of papers on Sunday describing, I thought, somewhat confusingly and cloak and daggerly, that there was a huge $1.5 billion offer for Arsenal to buy out both Kroenke and Usmanov. I was a bit confused because you really couldn't tell who these people were or indeed where they were from, apart from the fact that they're from the Gulf, I guess. Kroenke said he's not selling. Are you buying any of this? Or?
No, it doesn't really add up. The valuation doesn't add up, $1.5 billion. Certainly, they're not, the club's not worth that much, probably. I mean, actually, when you read behind the headlines, it was $880 million bid for 66% of the shares. So that values a little bit less than $1.5 billion. So the headline writers couldn't do the maths, and I'm not going to do it now. But, I mean, the fact is, Kroenke's not going to sell at this stage. Usmanov is richer than God. You can't displace him with an extra £4 or £5 on the value of a share. There'd be no value. And also, the details of the bid, they're going to pump loads of money in to, you know, for a huge transfer kitty. Oh, no one heard of financial fair play in the Middle East. I think what is interesting,
and also, they already have a big pile of cash to spend on transfers.
Well, exactly. I think what is interesting is I think we're on the cusp of a new era of takeovers. I think there's a realisation that this television deal is putting humongous money into the game, and it's worth buying a team and getting them into the Premier League. And I think there's a growing realisation that the next deal will dwarf this one in 2016. So I think we're going to see quite a few people getting into the game, or trying to get into the game. But, you know, I don't think they're going to be people who are getting in because they grew up wearing the shirt to the club. I think it's going to be a difficult time, and those clubs, those fans who are looking for investment and praying for investment, be careful what you wish for.
Well, in fact, if QPR stay up, Roy and I have already agreed to band together and lead a consortium to buy the side off of Uncle Tony. But that's, I guess that's for a future podcast. Huge match tomorrow. We're going to take a quick detour, but huge match tomorrow, obviously, at Old Trafford, United and Real Madrid. Dicko, you spent some time in Madrid. They're coming off, or I guess I don't want to say the reserve side, but a team packed with reserves beat Barcelona for the second time in 4 or 5 days. The script kind of suggests that it's not really an advantage to United to play the second leg at home, given how well Madrid counterattack. How do you see things playing out?
Well, I think you were right with that. I mean, Tony and I were talking about it earlier. I think you've got to see it probably 60-40 to Madrid, just partly on, well, on the potency of their attack, on the counter. I just worry that United will not be able to stop them scoring a couple of goals, and that's my main concern. If Ronaldo, assuming, you know, there'll be lots of speculation about whether Ronaldo will cope with the emotion of the occasion. Well, that might have been a justified worry 3 or 4 years ago, but I think he's too mature and too damn good to worry about that. I think Madrid will go through maybe 2 or 3-1.
Tony, are you that down on United? I mean,
I think both teams will score. I think Dicko's right, and I think the 20% advantage that Real have is down to Ronaldo. It's all about him. They've got weaknesses at the back; they can be exploited. But if Ronaldo's on, United are not going to be able to cope with them.
Rory, are you going to fly the flag for your Lancastrian brothers?
Not because they're Lancastrian, no. I think Real probably do. I don't know if it's 60-40 Real, because it suits them, as you say, to be counter-attacking, maybe have a slight advantage. But I've just got this feeling that we're going to see Sir Alex Ferguson tearing down the touchline in the 90th minute, in it with sort of coattails flapping behind him, sliding on his knees after sort of an average midfielder captain a rebound, so probably a goal from Anderson maybe. I don't know, I'd always side with the home team, given the occasion, the crowd, all that sort of intangible nonsense. So yeah, I don't know. Real, it will suit them counter-attacking, but I think United will squeeze through.
Yeah, I'm with Rory on this one. I could see United maybe winning 2-1. It's not a knock on Real Madrid, but let's not forget, this is Real Madrid's season right here. This is Mourinho's future right here. And you know, this is still a team, I think, which has some divisions. And it's very, very difficult to call, but I think United have a lot of weapons that they can exploit, possibly more than Real Madrid in a game like this, given the way it's likely to play out. All right, moving on to Stamford Bridge, where Chelsea hosted West Bromwich Albion. Now, because of the, I don't want to call it a rant, but let's say the extraordinary exchange of ideas Rafa Benitez had with the media on Wednesday following their 2-0 win at Middlesbrough. A lot of people were expecting Rafa to be pilloried and booed. I was just talking beforehand, actually, to our producer, Chris Skinner, about who was producing the game in his other job. About sort of what was going on, what they were expecting. Some people tweeting, oh, look, it's quiet here. Nobody's having a go at Rafa. Others saying, oh, wow, it's pretty nasty. I was at the game, and I thought there was a fair amount of venom. I think it was pretty obvious how a big portion of the Chelsea supporters feel about him, and in particular about whether he has a right to tell fans what to sing and whatnot. That said, in the same way that it's been for most of the season at Chelsea, they boo Rafa, but they get behind the team and they celebrate Jose Mourinho. And I thought that script was rather followed. But then I go home, I get the media like, oh, look, you know, nothing happened. It seems that, you know, Rafa's message worked. The fans are all quiet and they're behind him now. Tony, you're agitating?
Well, no, I'm just, we expected something more, didn't we? You know, we were told that, you know, Chelsea fans were so angry. You know, I wanted Rafa in the stocks. I wanted tomatoes thrown at him. I wanted a public execution. I wanted him burnt at the stake in the centre. You know, and they let me down, Chelsea fans. And, you know, it just proves the new fans have only just got into the game and, you know, then they brought their iPads and wrote little messages on them. No, it was terrible.
Did mean things about Rafa.
Yeah, you know, the fact is, what are they going to do? I mean, they're very conflicted, aren't they? They don't want Rafa. They never wanted him. But, you know, they can't spend the whole game. You don't go to the match to abuse the manager. You know, you've got to get behind the team. I mean, it's everyone's overblown it. And, you know, it's I expected a more hostile reaction. But it kind of, you know, it was about right, wasn't it?
Right, why did he take his job?
Well, because he couldn't turn down the opportunity to work for an elite club when he'd been out of work for 2 years. I think it's fairly obvious why he took the job. Of all the charges that's been laid against Rafa, the one that I find most astounding, and at this point I suppose I have to say, yeah, I did work on him with a book, so I am possibly biased, I'm trying not to be, but the one that I find really astounding is this idea that he's arrogant for taking the job and thinking he can win the fans over. How on earth is it arrogant to want to work for a club that you regard as being one of the best in the world? How is that arrogant?
Well, I'd say it's maybe, you know, you do a level of self-analysis, and if you look at the things that Rafa does really, really well, and he's shown, as he himself pointed out, I think he's won every trophy that you can win at club level. He's won league titles at Valencia. He's won the Champions League at Liverpool. He's very good tactically when he's got time to work with the
train is now approaching. Junction, at platform.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds.
Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Players, he wasn't going to have the benefit of a preseason. He's going to have a group of players that really weren't suited to the kind of football he's played in the past. He was expected just by showing up to turn Fernando Torres back into the player he was. Certainly anybody who's followed his career will tell you that being a diplomat and being a bit fake and being a bit of a bootlicker really isn't part of Rafa's personality, and those are all things that you frankly need to be if you're going to be the Chelsea manager in this environment. What I find shocking is that Chelsea could misread the situation this badly, and that he could misread the situation this badly. He's being asked to turn into something he's not.
There isn't a manager in football who doesn't have the arrogance to look at another club and say, you know what, I could do better there. I could make this work. And, you know, let's face it, you looked at that squad of players, and Rafa thought to himself, you know what, there's a bit of talent there. Get them organised, get them sorted. If that's arrogance, well, you know, that's what managers should have.
But Tony, there is an arrogance in the way Rafa's handled the last 2 years. He's had offers from other clubs from a tier or two below the elites, from sort of Atletico Madrid and Valencia and Wolfsburg and what have you. Yeah. And he's turned them down because he thinks he doesn't have to prove himself again. He shouldn't have to rebuild his CV. He thinks he should go in at the level of teams who can compete to win league titles and Champions League.
Yeah, definitely.
And that is arrogant, because to me, he has to. And I'm, you know, we probably have this conversation with people who know him better than we do. But to me, he does have to rebuild his reputation. He's got to accept that the last year at Liverpool went badly, Inter went badly. He's got to make himself desirable again. Taking Chelsea is actually humility. I agree with everything Gab said. The situation was wrong for him, but at the same time, all he had to do was, all he still has to do, is last 7 months, keep them in the Champions League, maybe win a trophy if he can win the FA Cup or the Europa League or whatever, and crucially, keep his mouth shut. And he could prove to the other big clubs in Europe that he's still someone who can put winning teams out on the field. The problem is that the results aren't quite there at the moment, and the incident last week, although I think it certainly wasn't, as some newspapers described it, as being premeditated, it was not a pre-planned statement. I think the problem is that if you were Real Madrid or Paris Saint-Germain, who are two of the teams that could potentially be looking for managers in the summer, you'd look at that and think, this man is not a politician, he's not a diplomat. That's the issue he's got.
I totally echo Rory's sentiment on this one. Word on West Brom, because they're ninth at the table, they had the great start, then they had the wobble, and then they kind of come back, and I was impressed with them. Sometimes I wonder if I'm watching different games, but I read all these things about, how brilliant Chelsea were with Rafa. I think Chelsea were brilliant at all, actually. I think in the front four, except for Oscar, I didn't think much really worked, and I thought West Brom had their chances as well. Peter Cech made a couple good saves, and in the end it was 1-0. But Dicko, what next for West Brom? I mean, you've reached this level. How do you advance the team now?
Well, I'm still, having tipped them as a dark horse of relegation this season, I'm still clinging to my tip. It's not too late, I think, if they lose every game. So no, I've been eating humble pie sent to me from the Midlands for several months now. How do they kick on? Well, they've got one of the best chairmen around. There's no doubt Peace would rival Hugh Jenkins from Swansea for that accolade, if there was one at the end of the season. I think it's going to be interesting what they do now. I mean, a lot of people there praise the work of Dan Ashworth, the guy who's now just started at the FA as the new technical director there, and say that he was, you know, absolutely instrumental in a lot of the great scouting, a lot of the great recruitment that they've had in the last decade. So it's going to be interesting how they, you know, how he is replaced, and whether we see a dip in that. I mean, I think yeah, that's because clearly a huge part of their success has been down to their ability to buy well. Simple as that.
And just to wrap this up, where I'm going to put my own special word on a West Brom player who I'd never really seen or heard of until very recently, because he didn't play in the Premier League and I don't follow the lower divisions. But this Gareth McCauley, who, as I've since found out, he's an Irish guy. He was an amateur footballer until he was like 22, 23 years old. He's like a plaster or something. He ended up someplace called Lincoln. He didn't even reach the championship until his late 20s. This to me, and he's holding his own on a team in the top 10. I think he's now 32, 33. this to me goes to show that the players are out there. Yeah. If you have competent scouts and know where to look, and I am sick and tired of managers whinging about needing backing from the manager and needing millions and zillions because, you know, this is a guy who came from nowhere.
I'm with you on this. Stop scouting by DVD.
Exactly.
Go and watch players.
Or scouting by agents instead.
Yeah.
And enough of this BS, too, about like, oh, well, you know, British players can't do this and that. He's not British. I think he's Irish. Still from the British Isles. It's still kind of the same thing. It's not like the dude's Brazilian, but he can go and he can hang in the Premier League. Okay, so Queen's Park Rangers, like Sunderland, like Swansea, like Norwich, I think, decide to go to Dubai to do some warm weather training, as a number of Premier League clubs like to do. I think also because they could probably get paid some money to do that, get a bunch of freebies. The difference is that all those clubs go, but only one club ends up in the newspapers, upsetting Harry Redknapp on Saturday. Big story about how they went out there and allegedly Redknapp and his missus stayed in a different hotel, and the players did train every day, but they were kind of done with training by 10:30, and then according to the story, they basically spent most of the rest of the time drinking and basically misbehaving. Now, Redknapp's been very angry about this. He denied this story. I think he says that in the end they had one night out where they went and they and, you know, they stayed up late and drank, basically. Now, Dick, I want to get your take on this because I think this story speaks a little bit to the way the media works and the way clubs work and some of our – you know, let's face it, some of our prejudices, some of what how we feel about Harry Redknapp versus those other players. And first of all, did you find it more believable that it was QPR and not Sunderland or Norwich? Do you think there's a different club culture there?
Well, I think there's a very problematic culture at QPR on all sorts of levels. I mean, the squad is about as wonky and dysfunctional and screwed up on wages, you know, talent, on the right balance of everything as any Premier League we've squad and any Premier League squad we've seen in a very long time. In terms of splits, absolutely, I believe that they've had all kinds of issues, but about different cliques, different camps. There's all sorts of players who've been, you know, rotting with no chance of getting in the first team for a long time. There've been other players who are on huge money who have been isolated. So yeah, at all sorts of levels, QPR have cultural problems. That's for sure. Whether that means they're all boozers is another leap.
But it just seems to me, Tony, that this QPR story gets in there, and perhaps other stories don't. And certainly, you know, Redknapp intimated that I was an agent, maybe an agent with a short name, I don't know, who was responsible for getting the story out. Obviously, we don't know where the truth lies. It's hard to think that everything's made up. Maybe that was exaggerated, but
I mean, footballers go out boozing when they've got time off. Shock, you know. I mean, and as Dickel
said, this wasn't time off. This was a work trip. They were there to train. They weren't. It's not like they were spending their holiday.
All right. Well, let's ask some fundamental questions. If it's a work trip, which, as you say, you think that they're being comped and that. Why did Harry take his wife? Why did he stay in a different hotel? Mixed messages being sent out everywhere.
Well, the rest of the QPR coaches stayed in the same hotel with the players, and Harry's wife doesn't work for the club, so, you know, she wasn't working.
So if I'm going abroad on a work trip, I'm not taking my wife. It's work. So, I mean, what message is sent out? You stay in a different hotel, and you're not with the team.
Maybe he didn't take her. Maybe it was just a coincidence that she was there staying in a different hotel. And Harry's thinking, like, all right, do I want to sleep in a big bed with my wife, or do I want to go and share a room with Joe Jordan?
Blimey, what are you doing here, Gail? I didn't know you were going to be here. I say, you want to share a room? I'll come up to your hotel.
Right. Are we not doing Sandra a massive disservice here? Maybe Sandra takes a brilliant conditioning session.
Well, maybe she was like, maybe she was working with the forwards because, you know, Darren Bent.
Yeah, exactly. No, I agree with Tony. I think that what I thought was really telling about the way the story was originally presented was this idea that if Harry had stayed in the same hotel, then he would have been able to control the players drinking. The players are professionals. They should know not to drink. They're bottom of the Premier League. They should be fighting for their careers, not thinking, oh, we're in Dubai for 5 days, let's get hammered. The abdication of responsibility is criminal.
Now, but also, we've alluded to this, but let's be blunt as well. I mean, without being sued, I hope, you know, the fact is that this story was placed. I mean, you know, Redknapp is not wrong when he says, you know, he talks about an agent. I mean, clearly this story was put in a newspaper willfully to try and cause maximum embarrassment to Queen's Park Rangers. Now, you know, my understanding is that, you know, there is some truth to the story, which means, you know, we shouldn't get away from that. But it also sums up QPR's problems, that there are people out there, and it sums up, you know, QPR's dysfunction going back now over a year or two, that there are people out there who are trying to undermine them in this way. It's reflective of wider QPR problems.
Is there also a bit of an issue here? Because I looked at the squad list after this came out, and there are some QPR players I know who I know hardly drink, and there's a bunch of them who are Muslim, so I know they don't drink. And there's a bunch of them who I don't know, and I don't want to stereotype about them, but based on the type of players they are and based on their background and based on, you know, who brought them to the club, you know, Warnock, I can kind of see them, you know, being more sort of, I can see their recreational drinking, you know, bringing back to the days of like Niall Quinn talking about what great spirit there was at Sunderland when they drive back from away games and they go to some pub and have a lock-in, and then you couldn't do that anymore because all these foreigners came in and you know, I guess ended everybody's fun. And I guess
people like you have spoiled it for us all.
Clearly. No, but I mean, is this some of the cultural division that Dicko was alluding to earlier?
Yeah.
And then, because it would strike me if I, let's say, was somebody who was closer to the group of QPR players who don't like to drink, but by the way, maybe they still like to party and they like to they like to have sex or hang upside down or whatever the hell it is that turns them on. Whereas an English person would rather, I'd rather, you know, go and drink heavily than have sex. If there is this kind of division here, this would explain how the story came out, right?
Well, I mean, let's face it, there is no club in the country that needed a bonding trip more than QPR. And, you know, and it's backfired in the worst possible way. Yet there are people with vested interests in making QPR and Harry look stupid, and it's worked.
Dicko, all that said, QPR won at the weekend. So the joke's on them, right?
Well, but people are confused. I mean, this trip was a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? It was sort of it was connected to the win, in the sense of Harry says he used it in his, you know, pre-match team talk. You know, guys, we're about to get a pummeling. Well, we have had a pummeling in the papers. Let's not make it any worse. But that's not really going to work as a motivational trick every week, unless they can arrange, I guess, for someone to write nasty things about them every Saturday morning, and then Harry can somehow use that to give them a kick up the backside.
I'm sure.
No, I think they've given themselves a fighting chance of staying in. I think was as long as they've got Remy playing and fit, he transforms their chances, because he's a proper striker. Without him, they've got no chance. With him, they've got a slender one.
And just to wrap this up, I was talking to somebody who's involved with the club, and they did make a point about why this is damaging in a way that we haven't brought up yet, but I think is worth mentioning. You know, Rory said before that you have a lot of fans or just people who go to the game, and, you know, they don't really care that much. QPR, I don't know. If you look at the cost of a season ticket there, you look at the size of the fan base, the demographics, there are people who really bust their rear end to make ends meet to go and support the club. And money does come into it, because when you hear about footballers making 40, 50, 60 grand a week, you expect a certain, you know, basically to play a football match, you expect a certain standard of behavior for them. And if these stories come out...
This is where it's all wrong. I don't think you do. What you do is you expect them 40, 50, 60 grand a week, you expect them to win, right? If they win, people don't give a toss.
No. But that's what I'm saying. But you expect the standard of behavior when you're losing. That's what I'm saying. They're bottom of the league. And I think this is what resonates, right? If I'm skipping meals to go and pay for my QPR season ticket, and then I have some of these guys who are bottom of the table and they're millionaires and they're taking the piss, then I'm kind of annoyed.
But in the aftermath of taking the piss, to go out and beat a team, especially rivals for relegation, you'll say, go ahead, boys, get out on the ale again this week and win again next week.
Yes, they did that, yeah. But I think you'll find that they increased their victory total this season by 50% with that one win.
Yeah, well, I mean, but if they can continue like that, QPR fans won't give a toss.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Shinji Kagawa, and it's a hat trick. The first one ever by an Asian player in the Premier League as Manchester United roll past Norwich 4-0. Dicko, can you please evaluate Kagawa's progress this season? And given the story James Ducker reported last week of a possible Paris Saint-Germain bid for Wayne Rooney, might Sir Alex have his replacement in-house?
Well, I don't think we should get too carried away. I mean, I thought that one of those finishes in particular was exquisite, wasn't it? When he just opened up his right foot and wrong-footed the keeper and the defender. But I've just checked, and those were his first goals since September. I know he's had some injury problems, but let's not get carried away. I'm not even sure he'll be in the team tomorrow night. So, great day for him, but I'm not getting out champagne yet and hailing him as the next Rooney.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a big Kagawa guy. Luis Suarez also nets a hat trick in Liverpool's demolition of Wigan. Tony, Brendan Rodgers thinks it's only his poor reputation with you people in the English media that will prevent him from winning Player of the Year. Personally, I could care less about stupid awards like Player of the Years, the PFA, the Football Writers, all that jazz. But I do care about your opinion as a longtime Liverpool watcher. How many Liverpool strikers can you name in the history of the club that you would take ahead of Suarez? And I do remind you, it is Kenny Dalglish's birthday today.
Kenny Dalglish.
Okay.
Happy birthday, Kenny. After that, you begin to wonder. Ahead of him, Torres at his best was an exceptional striker. But as Rory Smith would say, he was supply dependent, which Suarez isn't. Ian Rush had the longevity, but he was even more supply dependent and had the greatest of suppliers. Robbie Fowler just briefly was beautiful. How many would it take ahead of him? Kenny Dalglish.
There you go. Tony Evans says Luis Suarez is the second greatest Liverpool striker ever.
I didn't quite
take
say
the Twitter.
That. I didn't quite say that.
Stoke lose at home to West Ham at the weekend, and there are reportedly some murmurs of discontent among the fans, which Tony Pulis addressed, saying the club are kind of victims of their own success because fans expect improvement year on year, but it's extremely difficult. Rory, given the amount of money that has been spent, are Stoke where they should be, and should their fans maybe chill out a little bit and love the Pulis a bit more?
They should obviously respect everything that Pulis has achieved. That they have spent a lot of money, Stoke, far more than people maybe think, or that they certainly wouldn't sort of spring to mind when you think of the big spenders. What I would say, though, is that there's a kind of two sides to it, isn't there? There's the fact that fans obviously want improvement. They want to see teams moving on, achieving things, whereas Stoke do appear to have sort of found a formula to finish 14th in the Premier League. But that in itself is quite admirable, and always beware the example of Charlton.
Now, Expro, which I have to admit I had never heard of before late last night when I saw a story about them on our website, is apparently a football charity, and they claim 3 out of 5 Premier League footballers go bankrupt within 5 years of retirement, and that 1 in 3 gets divorced within a single year of retiring. Tico, do these numbers make sense to you, or do they feel entirely made up? And if they do seem plausible, what can be done?
If they are true, then what can be done? Footballers can start spending less money and sleeping around less, I guess. I don't buy them, do you? They sound made up.
They really do.
1 in 3 divorce within a year. I mean, footballers like to sleep around and they get plenty of opportunities, but I'm not buying that. And 3 out of 5
go bankrupt
in the modern age. I mean, there's been some famous examples of Lee Hendry at Villa and a few others who have gone.
There's so many, but they only mentioned two.
I'm not buying it. I don't know. X-Pro, who are they?
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed a bit weird. Sunderland are held by Fulham, and Martin O'Neill is angry at referee Mark Halsey for not awarding a penalty for Philippe Senderos' alleged handball. Tony, you were once a referee down in East LA, I believe. Can you explain the rules to Martin?
Yeah, well, first of all, what I'd like to do is explain that this question was originally intended for Rory Smith, but he thought himself above talking about Sunderland, Fulham. So let's put that into context. Clearly, it wasn't deliberate handball. And Martin O'Neill, like any manager who sees the ball at hand in the area and thinks he should have got a penalty and thinks he should have had 3 points, is going to complain about it. But, you know, there's a willful blindness to the rules of the game from managers and players that we see on a weekly basis.
There you go. Take that. Everton beat Reading 3-1, and they're still 3 points ahead of Liverpool. Rory, what are the chances they'll finish ahead of the Red Men, as Didi Haman likes to call them on Twitter, this season? And is Moyes justified in not committing to a long-term contract until the end of the season?
I think he probably is, yeah. I think he's at a stage now where he maybe needs to think about what he wants to achieve with his career, because Everton, sadly, beyond winning the FA Cup or maybe the League Cup, are never going to do more than they have over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, which is finish 4th, 5th, 6th or 7th, and always fall a little bit sort of short from actually challenging for major trophies. Yeah, I think whether they finish above Liverpool this year is difficult. Everton have got quite a tricky run in. They still have to play Liverpool, I think, as well as a couple of the other sort of Champions League contender sides. It's getting closer. On the balance of the season, Everton probably would deserve to finish above them just, but it'll be tight.
Okay, it's the Gab One For You section of the show, but I haven't actually written a question. So today, and today only, Tony, Rory, Dicko, any one of you that would like to, can ask me any European football-related question, and I will do my best to answer it.
Gab, tell me something I don't know about Belgian football, which I should warn you is an awful lot.
Well, something you should know, given that you've been to Egypt at the company's expense and talked to a lot of people, is that there's an Egyptian businessman who's struck up a deal with Lierse and a team in the third division, which his name escapes me right now, where basically, because all these Egyptian players from the Egyptian league are currently unemployed because the league isn't, they're not employed, but they're not playing football, he's loaned them all to Belgium, and there's just third division side. I think that's KV Turnhout, I think they're called, who've just added like 12 guys from the same Egyptian side. And also at Lierse, I think there's 6 Egyptians now on loan there. And he has a financial interest in both teams, and it's caused a fair bit of controversy. But my take is, hey, these guys are professional footballers. They deserve to be playing. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. It's been real. Thanks to my guests, Tony Evans, Rory K. Smith, and from beautiful downtown Mortlake, it's Matt Dickinson. Come find us on Twitter. We're all on there. You can share your thoughts, especially Tony's thoughts about the greatest Liverpool striker ever and where Luis Suarez ranks on that list, behind Kenny, of course. Happy birthday, of course, to Kenny Dalglish as well. You can email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk, as so many of you do every week. And remember, of course, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find news, views, web chats, blogs. Look out for my blog on Tuesday, and you'll find some of the best analysis out there. Till next week, bye-bye.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.